While they were eating, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take and eat. This is my body." Then he took the cup, gave thanks, and offered it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. On reaching the place, he said to them, "Pray that you will not fall into temptation." He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them, knelt down and prayed, "Father, if you are willing, take this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done." An angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. And being in anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like drops of blood falling to the ground. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." "I told you that I am he," Jesus answered. "If you're looking for me, then let these men go." Then the detachment of soldiers, with its commander and the Jewish officials, arrested Jesus.
With his stripes we are healed. Thank you.
The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is, the praetorium, and called together the company of the soldiers. They put a purple robe on him and twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again, they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you're going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days. Come down from the cross and save yourself." The same way the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he cannot save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood there in front of Jesus, heard the cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Hymn number 283. What wondrous love is this? Let us stand to sing.
I will sing, while millions
To us, the events of Maundy Thursday and Good Friday seem so very far away in time, far away in distance, thousands of years and thousands of miles. But have you ever considered how the greater distances of history are measured? For the universe is so vast that we must measure its distance in light years, light that travels more than 186,000 miles per second. Multiply time 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes in an hour and 24 hours in a day and 365 days in a year. Such huge expanses. And so you know that by comparison, the distance from Jerusalem to Minneapolis is so minutely small. Or consider how the clock of eternity runs. For eternity may be measured by the tens of millions of years, by the hundreds of millions, by the billions of years. For eternity is forever and ever and ever. And so by eternity's clock, 2,000 years, it's barely a tick or a tock on the clock. All of which is to say that by comparison, we here tonight are so very close to Jerusalem. We here tonight are so very near to the year AD 30 when those events took place. So near in time, so near in space, it could just as well be this Thursday or this Friday. What would it be like if it were tonight? If it were tonight that Jesus and his dozen disciples were gathered together in the dining room of a South Minneapolis Rambler, a borrowed house and a borrowed meal, for the last dinner, supper, that ever they would share together. A meal that would fit our culture as that ancient meal fit its culture. So on the table might be chicken or beef or pizza or tacos, and there would be wine and bread. A conversation that would ramble over all of the things that we talk about, for they talked about the common things of their day. Discussions of what's happening in Eastern Europe, or the way the weather has been so strange, unusually warm in the winter and so cold before Christmas and here into the spring. Or what's happening in hockey with the North Stars in the Stanley Cup playoffs, or any of the other events that ordinarily fit a conversation. But Jesus tonight has something on his mind. Well, not that he has said that. You couldn't quite tell from his words, but look, I mean, just look at him and you can tell. There's almost a horror of anticipation in his eyes. You sense that something is terribly, terribly wrong, that there's some kind of tragedy to come. And when the others try to lighten him up with jokes that ordinarily he would have laughed at, there seems to be no laughter. There seems to be no cheering up of Jesus. those around the table with him, a tight team. They've been a lot of places and they've spent a lot of time together. Sort of like a team with a coach, with an intense loyalty that has been built through all of the experiences. They've traveled all over the area, from the north of Minnesota to the south and from the west to the east. Often they've traveled by bus, sometimes they've walked. Most often they've traveled together in a large van, big enough for all 13 of them to travel in at the same time. They've been places and seen extraordinary things, like at the beginning of Jesus' ministry here in Minnesota when he went to a wedding reception at the Sofitel in Bloomington. And at that reception, the wine ran out and he performed a miracle and wine came from the kitchen faucets and they were served there. And they were astounded at what he was able to do. And then when he began to preach and the crowds that came, filling to overflowing the cathedral in St. Paul and the basilica in Minneapolis. And then the time that they opened the doors of the Met Center, and even that time when Jesus and his preaching crowded out the Metrodome downtown. And then those disciples remember, how could they ever forget it, those extraordinary visits made to Abbott Northwestern Hospital and Fairview Southdale Hospital when Jesus boldly went into rooms where he had been invited or not. And those who were desperately ill that the physician said would surely die, he spoke a word or gave a touch and they stood to their feet and they walked out more healthy than they had ever been. And then the most stunning of all, that time when he walked days after the funeral to Lakewood Cemetery in Hennepin Avenue. And he shouted at a closed tomb. And a dead man named Lazarus came out. Everyone there was so shocked that there were barely words to describe it. They knew he was great, but that he could command life and death. And yet it was not just the good times. It was the bad times that had bound them together as a team. It was the criticism. It was the misunderstanding. It was the constant harassment that came from the pastors and the religious leaders all over the metropolitan area. The things that were written in the paper and the gossip that was passed around in places of business. That time when Jesus' own family was so embarrassed by him that they sought a court order to have a psychiatric evaluation because they thought that he had gone mad. These and all the other things had bound them together into a solidarity that made them feel as if they were one, those 13. They were zealots for a cause. They were members of a team together. And that's what made it so difficult when Judas left. They felt a hollowness because of that empty place at the table. They tried to understand, but couldn't. They couldn't figure out if he had quit or if Jesus had fired him. And just as they were trying to figure it out, it seems that Jesus did a very strange thing. He picked up a slice of bread taken out of the wrapper that held it when it was bought just a few hours earlier at a store, took that slice of bread and held it up and said, "I want every one of you to take a piece. Now, take, eat. This is my body, which is for you." They didn't think they had any idea what he was talking about. And in the midst of their confusion, he reached and he took his glass and he held that up and said, "I want you to drink with me, for this glass is the new covenant in my blood. This do in remembrance of me." And clumsily, they all picked up their glasses and they drank as Jesus drank. There was a heaviness to the moment that was hard to explain. It was Andrew who thought that difficult moments in the past had somehow unusually been handled by music. It was he who had played the guitar and the synthesizer and the other instruments in all of their times together before. And so it was Andrew, this time without instrument at all, who began to sing a hymn. And it was like the old times, except Judas wasn't there. Like the old times, as those men blended their voices together, Jesus singing along. And Andrew thought in his mind that they would sing that same hymn again, and maybe a dozen more, perhaps 20, and it would make everything all right. But when that hymn was once sung, it seemed there was no more singing left in them. And so when they sang a hymn, they went out. They got in their van and they drove off. Peter at the wheel and not a word spoken. And they went where Jesus asked, and it was to the park where they had so often gone before when Jesus wanted to pray. And there at the park, more strange things took place. He walked with them to the picnic tables, and they were seated there, and he said something he had never said to them before. He said, "I'm going to ask you to do a favor for me." For it had always seemed that they were asking favors of him, but never did Jesus ask a favor of them. But this time he did. He said, "I ask that you wait, and I ask that you pray for me." They had always thought it was Jesus who always would pray for them. But this time it was they who prayed. Prayed as Jesus went off alone and knelt under some trees. He knew that he was going to die. And he didn't want to. He knew that he was going to suffer as no one had ever suffered before or would ever suffer again. And he did not want to do it. He knew that this was the moment now nearly come for which he had been born. And yet he asked that it might be taken away. He knew that in less than a day, he would die in the outskirts of a suburb of Minneapolis. But not just there. Not just for those that would be the witnesses, but for the prostitutes on Hennepin Avenue, and for the preachers in their fancy church buildings. For people in his day and people in every day. He knew that the time was near, and he had one single prayer that he asked of his Father. He said, "Father, can't you find some other way? Isn't there some way out of this?" And God said, "No, there is no other way." And so depression set in. The anguish began. The horror was so great that the sweat beaded up on his brow and soaked his body and fell to the ground like huge droplets of blood. Oh, there are so many other details that could be told. They're almost impossible to believe. Things that you would never expect in our time, in our place. How the National Guard was used, actual soldiers brought out to arrest him, far more than was needed. And they in the middle of the night. And how they brought him to an open courtroom, special arrangements made before a Hennepin County judge who ordered extraordinarily his execution. For the country has said that now the right of capital punishment is given individually to the states. He was accused of all kinds of things he had never done, including high treason. And from that courtroom to the governor's office, but the governor would not intervene. And from there to the federal district court, where the judge was awakened by a phone call in the middle of the night, but he would not stop the proceedings. It seemed as if insanity had taken control. And it was the decision to crucify him that was the most bizarre of them all. Somehow that judge thought that this horrible old way of execution was fitting.
the right thing to do. And so he ordered the county sheriff to get the necessary lumber and to form some crosses, to plant them just off the shoulder along the interstate south of Minneapolis. And in his order to do it quite right, he got enough lumber to make 3 crosses. Got 2 inmates from death row in Stillwater and brought them as well. And then they did it. They actually took real spikes with real hammers and drove them through his hands and through his feet. They nailed him like a poster to a tree. And as they did, the crowds began to gather. They'd read about it in the Star Tribune, heard about it on the radio. They came, the strange kind of people that come to ugly events. Their attitude itself ugly and mean. They shouted at him. They laughed.